So March 8th, 2025, Saturday evening at a bikery, and opened up the schedule a little bit more and giving the opportunity for people just to be able to spend the afternoon out in the forest. It's a very beautiful time right now. And it's got maybe 4 or 5 more days until there's rain that's supposed to start again. And so we do have that opportunity to live outside here at Abayagiri. And the birds, the wild animals, there's animal tracks that we can see on the roads and on the trails. And it's a good opportunity to connect with nature. There's a lot of deer around these days, and they seem to have kind of evolved. These deer, that they've evolved in a different way. I've always thought of deer as kind of semi-solitary animals where you'd see little families of them, but now you're seeing groups of 10, 15, even 20, almost like they've evolved into herd animals. And talking a little bit with Tanrakito, and he said that does happen sometimes, that based on conditions, then different generations of animals will evolve in different ways. And it's kind of the same with us, with the practitioners. Then different generations of practitioners end up evolving in different ways. So we can think of the generations of practitioners since the time of the Buddha, the great disciples of the Buddha, and then their own disciples, and so on, over hundreds of years, over couple and a half millennia, and every single generation, every single person going through those stages of life of being young and growing up and having experiences, and those people who kept the Buddha Sasana going, having experiences in their practice, experience and realization, and growing old and having their own students, and then those older disciples of the Buddha passing away, and the students growing up, having their own students passing away, and so on, and to the present day. And I think it's so interesting how this keeps going on and on and on. And then the truths that we study, the anicca, dukkha, anatta, and the path, sila, samadhi, punya, then that just... those principles never change. So that's the akalika dhamma, that's the timeless nature of the dhamma, that these principles of the teachings never change, however advanced or however backward a society may be, then these principles still apply. And things are just always changing and evolving, and they don't remain static. And sometimes I think about, Lungpo Pisano. He tells the stories about being with Lungpo Cha in the early days at Wanungwapong. Or we might know a lot of the stories of Lungpo Samedo, talking about the training with Lungpo Cha and a lot of the experiences then. And it just seems so distant, so long ago. And yet, that's the nature of time. So in the present moment, things seem to be lasting, and there's various issues and the people we live with and the issues we might be dealing with in the moment, and illnesses or bodily problems we might be dealing with in the moment. And then time passes and it fades into memory, and some of those issues arise, and then those become prominent. So sometimes we can think back, say I can think back to being an Anagarika or a novice or a new monk at Abayagiri, and there were various issues in my mind that seemed very, very real. And then now it's hard to remember even what was on the mind at that time. Or things that, say, trying to remember a thought of anger or a thought of greed from 20 years ago, and what was the point? What was it useful? Was it beneficial? And sometimes it can think about various mental states we may have had in the past, and we can contemplate, were they useful? Were they beneficial? Or did they just fade and maybe they did some damage and it was not so useful? So one aspect of mindfulness, there's this curious phrase in the suttas that one remembers what is said and done even long ago. So it has something to do with memory. I don't know if translating mindfulness itself as just memory is necessarily the best translation, but it is very much linked with memory and recollection. And if we can recollect and remember what we said and did even long ago, then we can also recollect and remember the results of what we said and did long ago. And that can inform us and help us in the present, and it can help as an aid to our learning. So mindfulness, it involves a lot of recollection. And then when the Buddha talks about right mindfulness, for example, mindfulness of the body, it's not just focusing on bodily sensations or bodily feelings, but it's recollecting, it's thinking. It's thinking about the nature of the body, recollecting the impermanent nature of the body, recollecting the things that make up the body, the external organs, the internal organs, the earth element things that make up the body, the water element things that make up the body, the fire element or heat and cool aspect of the body, the air element, the breath, the upgoing winds, downgoing winds, space element, any void spaces within the confines of our body. And then there's the consciousness element, the element of experience that is experienced through the body, through the eye, ear, nose, tongue, the tactile sensations in the body itself. So there's all these elements that make up our being, or make up just this body. And that's thinking about that, contemplating that, reflecting on that is part of right mindfulness, is part of mindfulness of the body. And then we recollect the impermanent nature of the body. So this includes these charnel ground contemplations that the Buddha talks about in the body mindfulness teachings, where we recollect the different stages of decomposition that this body would undergo if it was to die and just be cast away in a charnel ground. And it just goes through these stages of decomposition naturally. We can, as an aid to contemplate these, that's one of the benefits of living outside. We might come across an animal that has died. I know in up on the mountain near one of the kutis, there was a deer that died or maybe was killed by something, and it was being eaten and was decomposing. And eventually it just decomposed following that natural way of, there was less and less of it, and then eventually it was just bones and kind of flesh plastered on the outside of the bones. And we can use those types of contemplations just to think about that's what this body is. This body is of that same nature. It's got those same constituent elements. As also, you can get really creative with this. And again, just I want to emphasize that it's not just a samadhi practice. It's not just focusing on the breath or just trying to get into deep state of meditation, but this mindfulness of the body is very much can be we call it analytical or discursive meditation, where we're actually considering, what is this? Do I really know what this is? Do I really know that there's a skeleton inside of this body all the time? And one of my reflections that's coming up for me today was actually I was trying to imagine the nerves in my body. because of the sciatica that I've been dealing with. I was trying to actually imagine the nerves in the body. When I went to the massage with Chow the other day, he had an app which had a very highly detailed body, three-dimensional body, where you could zoom in, and he was showing me where the nerves were, and you could see the muscles and then the nerves, and you could turn on and off different layers. And so I was kind of fascinated by this, seeing which muscles the sciatic nerve weaves in and out of and where exactly it's located, and then feeling those locations in my own body. And that thing, that nerve that's causing me pain, is inside of me. So all these things, they're inside of us. The bones are inside of us. The nerves are inside of us. The muscles are inside of us. And we just carry these around all the time. And any way we move, they move with us. And it just makes up this body. It's just the way it is. And ultimately, the reflection of Longpo Cha having that realization that he was so afraid of death when he was practicing in the charal ground, and then asked himself, well, where is death? And then seeing that, well, death is within me. Death is just inherent in this system. So with those types of insight can be gained through the meditation on the body, the recollection of the body. And of course, another way to do it is just to feel the different aspects of the body and to do body scanning. That's also a great thing to actually, if we're tired of thinking, if the mind has done enough thinking, and we do want to collect the mind, calm down a bit, then we could do the body scanning, starting at the top of the head and feeling the sensations on the top of the head going down to the eyes, the face, and so on. And then consciously relaxing all those parts and then checking in with every part of the body, seeing where there might be tension, seeing what can consciously be relaxed, consciously be calmed. What parts are comfortable, what parts are perhaps in pain or discomfort. And seeing if we can make any micro adjustments to the body, to the posture, that might make ourselves more comfortable and make the posture more sustainable. So that can be another way to do it. There's the consciousness element. I was reminded of a teaching by Ajahn Lee, where there's actually all sorts of bacteria and consciousness within the body as well. It's hard, if not impossible, to say where we end and where the other consciousnesses inside of our body begin. And there's all sorts of bacteria in the digestive system, and there's all sorts of parts of the body that might seem to have a mind of their own. There's the sympathetic systems and the parasympathetic, the automated systems in the body. And then sometimes these systems go to war with each other. And it's reminded that Ajahn Jeff, talking about this one time, said gang wars within the body that are happening all the time. So sometimes they aren't necessarily helping each other, but they're at war with each other. Or you think of something like cancer, where the body starts attacking itself. There's a mass in the body that other parts of the body start attacking it. So sometimes there are these seeming malfunctions that happen, but they're not actually malfunctions, because it's just the impermanent nature of the body. However it's going to play out, we don't know. It is going to be impermanent. It is in flux. It is impermanent. But how that impermanence is going to play out, you can't predict. But it's going to play out somehow. So when we are able to reflect on the body like this, then there can be that sense of acceptance and that sense of surrendering to the moment. Yeah, it's very, very interesting too, because why would we even do these practices? Why does the Buddha say that mindfulness of the body leads to the deathless? Just thinking about these very mundane things that make up our body, thinking about hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, and skin, those things are not profound. Those things are just what they are. They're just ordinary. So why would reflecting on, contemplating those things lead to the deathless? You know, why is that? It would seem that, well, no, that's not what's going to lead to the deathless. The super samadhi is going to lead to the deathless. The extremely profound, deep samadhi spiritual experiences, the kind of flashing lights and whatever psychic phenomenon we might be able to experience. But then the Buddha comes back to, well, mindfulness of the body, hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, and skin. This is these things, gaining insight into these things, these very things, is leading to the deathless. It seems strange. Why would the Buddha talk like that? So it's just these ordinary things, and getting creative with it, we can actually have fun with it. We can see in what way the mind might be infatuated with these things. So this is what a lot of the Kribhajans are teaching. This is the forest Dhamma, where we see what the mind is actually, the types of things the mind is becoming infatuated with, and then seeing, well, what's the true nature of these things, and what's the big deal? Coming back to that idea of disciples of the Buddha and the disciples of those disciples and so on, all the generations up to the present day. It's also very interesting because, as something I was also reflecting on today, was what do we want from teachers when we learn something from a teacher, or when we have a teacher? And I try to think of the way I've related to my own teachers in the past, and how, you know, what do we want to see in a teacher, or what do we expect from a teacher? And I think that it's a tough one, because it's when we talk about the deathless or these very high-minded things, then what we want to see in a teacher is some very, very inspiring qualities. We want a teacher to be the best of the best, and have extremely inspiring qualities, and not do anything wrong. And so it's a tough one, because when you have a teacher, say in the Buddhasasana, we expect the highest, like the Buddha himself, and then but then what we find is our teachers are humans, and even there's this story of Ajahn Sumedho. And when he was living with Lompo Cha, and Lompo Cha would say things like, you know, if you see something I do that's wrong, if you find a fault with me, then please, you know, don't be afraid. My Dong Grang Jai, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid to let me know. And of course, all the Thais would never do that. A Thai monk would never want to find fault with Lompo Cha, at least not any of his disciples. But, Lompo Sumedho, being a Westerner, he could do that. So then he approached Lompo Cha one day and said, I found fault with you. And I don't know what the fault was, actually. Maybe somebody could tell me sometime if they know what the fault was. But that, just the point being, you know, genuinely, I saw you do something wrong. I actually have a real fault that I found with you. And Ajahn Chah said, yeah, good, good. That's good you don't think I'm perfect, because then you might look for the Buddha outside of yourself. So I think it's Lompo Cha, being a great teacher, he's always pointing people back to themselves. He's not pointing at himself. He's pointing people back to themselves. And really, that's what the Buddha was doing as well. Or we have the phrasing from the Buddha saying, you know, if somebody could be hanging onto his robe day and night, following him around. But if they're not following his teaching, they're far from the Buddha. But if someone's never even met the Buddha before, but they're following the teaching, they're always with the Buddha. They're always close to the Buddha. So I've tried to think, yeah, what I've, you know, when I first came to Abhayagiri, what I wanted to see in a teacher was a hero. The teachers want need to be heroes, great heroes who are achieving great things and doing all sorts of unbelievable things. But that's actually in speaking of unrealistic expectations. We think we want our leaders to be heroes and great people. We want our teachers to be heroes and people who are really, really just transforming the masses. But that's an unrealistic expectation. So we're all in this together. We're all disciples of the Buddha. We're all in this together. Of course, some teachers will be extraordinary. You think of beings like Lompur Mun, Lompur Cha, and so on, that these extraordinary beings with the parami to truly transform the masses and actually be great. But that's rare. And it is unrealistic to expect that from all teachers. And some teachers might just have one or two students, and that's normal. Or some monks who ordain might not have any students. They might go through their whole life just focusing on their own practice, and that's their parami, that's where that's at. So it's going to be different for everybody. But we do have to come to that point where it's just good enough. So like at Abhayagiri, things are good enough. The community is harmonious, and we're helping out, we're looking after each other, we're all in this together, and we're all trying to practice according to our abilities, and with everybody helping out, it's like a team. So I think when I think of this community here, you know, we might think, oh yeah, we're, you know, as far as monastic communities that are training in the world, you know, maybe we're just kind of trying to scrape by, just trying to find a little bit of happiness in the monastic life. And we might think, yeah, we might compare ourselves to perhaps great communities of the past, or we might think, well, you know, how far can I really get in the practice in this place? But I think with the level of harmony and then the teamwork that it gets exhibited in this monastery, I think that's already quite good. It's already quite good, and we can really make use of this. We're day in and day out. We've got the chanting and the meditation that we do. And if you think of us as a team, then we might think, oh yeah, well, if we think of ourselves as a team, we're not going to win the championship. We're just kind of low down on the ladder in terms of teams. But I think of the community of Baigiri kind of like the Mighty Ducks. We're kind of like a group of people who come from various backgrounds, and we're kind of learning to work together. But then it is actually possible that we can win the championship, and we just have to train. The level we get to is just going to be exactly proportional to the effort we're willing to put into this mindfulness of the body, these practices that the Buddha's recommending, and the sense of teamwork, the sense of helping out. And that's, however much dukkha we're able to let go of, that's going to be proportionate to the mindfulness we're willing to cultivate and the effort we're willing to put into practice. Not necessarily heroic effort, but balanced effort. Can we put a balanced effort into the practice? So the fairly short time we have left for winter retreat, we do have this opportunity, and with the slightly more open schedule, we can do things like spend time outside. You can find a tree, sit at the foot of a tree, know the right types of trees. Don't want to sit at the foot of a tree and get covered in ants. So sometimes sitting at the foot of a oak tree might not work so well because there'll be a lot of ants. Sitting at the foot of a bay laurel tree might work better. Sitting at the foot of a pine tree, there might be sap. We have to know which trees drop sap and which trees are worth sitting at the foot of, so we can do some explorations outside. We also have a number of empty dwelling places, so if we know one of the empty kutis, then a nice thing to do when there's a lot of time is find an empty dwelling place, grab the rake or the broom that's there, sweep it up a little bit, do some sitting there, doing some walking meditation there. That's a really nice practice to do when we have a lot more time like this. And really picking up in earnest those practices such as mindfulness of the body, of contemplation of impermanence, and so on. We do have this precious opportunity. So I think I won't go on too long this evening. I'll just leave it there as some reflections to consider for today.